It's Friday, October 2nd, 2009, and you're listening to episode 164 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 26 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And my name's Chris.
I wasn't aware that we had a democracy.
A pneumocracy?
A pneumocracy, yes. What? It's full of error.
I thought it was a dictatorship.
I was not aware we had a democracy.
Are you going to go full on liberal on us again?
Much less that we had come to conclusion as to whether it was a presidential or parliamentary democracy. But I have come to learn from our forums that, in fact, we not only have a democracy at Fear the Boot, but it is a presidential democracy.
Yes. Does it make me a bad citizen that I didn't vote?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Are they going to give us the right to arm bears?
Well, probably so.
If not, they
okay.
should.
Because our forums, unbeknownst to me until this was already well on its way, had elections.
Indeed.
For president and vice president.
And president of vice.
President of vice. I'm sorry. Yes. But what I came to learn is that president of vice is, in fact, an appointed position and not an elected position.
Right.
I'm sorry.
No, it is.
What I came to learn was that it's an elected position and not an appointed position.
Correct.
Okay.
Your mom's an elected position.
Your mom's face is an electric position.
Electric position?
Okay, Chad, you're at an 11 and we need you at a 6.
No.
My personal life is like at a 2.
Chad,
my professional life is
a
9.
You're at a Chad and we need you at about a Pat.
I might as well get in my car and go
home. You know what? If you would do that, that would be fantastic.
It's good to have you back, Pat.
Pat, how about you play me today and I'll play you? Go.
Well, you know, I was just thinking the other day about... No, I'm not going to let you talk because...
So I find out about these elections, and I just wanted to let you know, Fear the Boot community, that you now have a president.
And a president of vice.
Wherever you live, whatever country you are in, whatever form of governance you are used to, you now have a new president, which is Noble Bearer. Mm-hmm. And you have a president of vice,
yes,
which is Zeke Copperize, a.k.a. Christian, who's one of our tough bitches. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make you aware that these individuals are now in control of your life.
I want you to know that I did not vote this way, but I support our new president to the extent that I have a T-shirt, or at least it's coming to me, proclaiming my support for these two candidates.
Well, I accept that and I respect that. That's the virtue of democracy. Mm-hmm. If you can say at the end of it, even if I didn't vote for this person, they are still my president. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, whether you voted for somebody else or didn't vote at all, your president currently is Noble Bear.
Indeed.
And if you object to that, you have no one but yourself to blame. Because in a vote that was won by probably a margin of about 10 people, then even if your one vote doesn't matter, 10 would have.
That's
and
right.
So if you had yourself and 9 sock puppets to vote with, which is forbidden by our forum policies, but hey, that doesn't stop anybody else in any other democracy. Why should it stop you on Fear the Boot?
Vote early, vote often.
Yeah, vote early, vote often. Look, if we've learned nothing else from the Ennies, and we haven't.
No, we haven't.
It's the internet. It's all about fraud.
So was their first official act to actually sabotage and take down the forums?
Yeah, apparently.
No, I should probably explain that. If you're listening to this episode and you're having trouble finding feartheboot.com.
Yeah, because it just didn't take down our forum.
Yeah, what on earth happened?
We were bought by Wizards of the Coast.
Short story, I don't want to go into great detail for security reasons, but the server's behaving in unexpected ways, and neither myself nor the people whose job is to take care of the server can explain why. And so the server was taken down for some testing and some maintenance. And there's a very good possibility that over the coming week or so, the server may disappear completely while they reformat the machine. The good news is I do run FTP backups. So the forum, the blog, none of that stuff is going to be lost.
The only thing that is going to be lost are all of Dan's capital ship essays and then we can all agree that nothing of value was lost.
No.
I think the forums just imploded under the weight of Chad's talkiness.
I think they imploded under the weight of Capital Ship Combat essays.
If
100,000 words on broadside.
Let me I say more, people. I mean, here he goes.
First of all. Pat is right. Chad, if that was the case, this episode would me be signing off unto suicide. And that's not happening. So I want to let you guys know there may be a day or two where feartheboot.com disappears. There is nothing per se catastrophic going on. It just may be we have to reformat the server. All the database stuff is regularly backed up to a separate server, to a separate machine. Nothing will be lost. There just may be a day or two where you go to feartheboot.com and all you see is a coming back soon page. That's not a sign of any catastrophe. We're not.
It's just a sign of pod fade.
You do realize that everything you're saying right now, by the time this episode comes out, is going to be completely resolved.
Yeah.
No, actually, it won't be because I intend to delay it until after this episode's been out for a little bit. But I do realize, Chris, you're kind of a moron because you just sort of make things up that you have no idea
about.
Well,
didn't you guys record another episode last week after I was gone?
Nope. It fell apart.
We tried.
Technical problems.
Oh, so you weren't able to do it because I wasn't there.
Yeah, sure. Whatever helps you sleep at night. Now, Fear the Con 3, I'm hoping to lock down the dates within the next week or two.
Oh.
We are looking at not the first weekend of March, but like the second or third weekend. Whatever, it's in the early teens. I don't have a calendar in front of me. Our previous two Fear the Cons were on the first weekend of March, which was the time change weekend, and was hard on a bunch of people for a lot of reasons. If you want to tentatively, and let me stress tentatively, pencil in some dates, presume it will be the weekend of March that's in the early teens, not the one that's like the 7th through the 8th. It'll be like the 12th through the 13th.
And that's
it'll
because be Dan likes the early teens.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'm sorry, Pat.
So, and Dan. And Wayne.
What's not to love?
There's a reason why they call it jail bait and not jail hate. But anyway. That's
on the field, baby.
Wow.
Wayne.
Child molestation. Great joke, Pat.
Oh, wait, Wayne, I got a question for you.
I don't know what we're talking about anymore.
Is Wayne short for something like Waynard or something?
Waynard.
No.
Yes.
No, it's not.
No, yes, it is. It is now.
Waynard.
Waynard. Googlygopped the third.
If you look at my birth certificate, I always go by Dan. Right. But my birth certificate says Daniel. His birth certificate does not say Chadwick. It says Chad. His real name is Chad.
Right.
Chad is not short for anything. I've known some people who go by Bill, but their birth certificate says William. I've known other people who go by Bill, but their birth certificate says Bill.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
Okay, so I was just curious.
Wayne is actually short for anything normally.
No, I don't know of anything.
Okay, I just made that up.
What was it? Etymology of...
But you... No, I... Well, etymology would be the history of words.
Etymology. Yeah. What did I say? Did I say entomology? That's bugs.
That'd be bugs, yes.
It's actually my middle name.
Actually, it's Wayne's coding, and he just goes by Wayne.
All right. So...
I actually kind of like that.
Yeah?
Wayne's coding. You sound very English and very refined.
Wayne's coding Ascot the third.
Esquire.
Esquire the fourth.
So, Wayne, there's something that you and I were bitching about.
There's quite a few things we were bitching about, but I think I know where you're going with
it. It's not appropriate. It's not fair that we bitch off the air and don't bitch on the air. Not that we're really ever on the air at all, but that we don't bitch on these recordings, which is video game length. Now, this first came to my attention when I was playing through Arkham Asylum.
Yep, and we shared the same frustration over Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, specifically.
Two,
Marvel Ultimate Alliance 1 was actually a pretty freaking long game. But our frustration's over video game length. Because I am used to playing JRPGs, sandbox RPGs, or even these pseudo-sandbox RPGs like Fallout. I'll sit down and I'll play the game 40 hours, 80 hours. I think my record was close to 120 hours on a single video game. Now, I recognize 120 hours is unusual. But the point is that I'm used to a game taking me generally at least 40 to 80 hours to beat.
Yeah, 40 is about average, I would say, for what I'm looking for out of a game.
Right. If you look at your entertainment as dollars divided by time, I will still say tabletop role-playing games are about the best investment you can make. But still, if you look at your dollars divided by time, I expect a video game to work out generally to about a buck an hour. If we look at replayability and such. And I was shocked.
You know what I'm shocked by?
What's that?
That the name Wayne, boy's name, pronounced Wayne, is of Old English origin, and its meaning is wagon builder or wagon driver. It's an occupational name.
Huh. Yeah, Wayne.
Has two variants. Wayne, which is W-A-I-N, like a Wainwright, or Wayne, W-A-Y-N.
You know,
shouldn't there be an E on the end of that?
No, W-A-Y-N is one of the variants, like an Old English variant.
I guess my name's always been a little easier to understand because being a Hebrew or biblical name.
Yeah, it's got some history behind it.
Yeah, I say Dan means to judge, El means God. And so while I'm not an expert in Hebrew, I would presume that the I in the middle there is some kind of transitive verb or something. And so because Daniel means God is my judge, or I will only be judged by God. Or there's a couple ways to interpret it.
You know, the meaning of my name has changed, apparently. Because when I was a kid, you look it up in baby books and stuff, and even on the internet years ago, my name was short for Chadwick. I mean, that's where it comes from. Right. My personal name, as we said, is not Chadwick, but it's an Old English name, and it means brave warrior or brave knight.
Now it means he who talks a lot.
If you want it to be. But now it means something different. I forget what it means. Like, if you look it up now, it means something different, and it's not brave warrior anymore. Locatious. So I don't know what changed. How about I just sit here in silence like you, Pat?
I hope so. But anyway,
it'll get you a following.
So I get kind of shocked as I'm playing through Arkham Asylum, and I beat the main game in, I didn't time it, but just estimating mentally, somewhere to 10 to 15 hours. And I had all the side stuff beaten, not counting the challenge modes for anyone that owns the game. I had all the Riddler puzzles and stuff done, tops another couple hours.
You know, and I can beat that. Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, 3 days, every character unlocked. And two of those days I was working, so I only played after work. I'm someone who doesn't even normally beat video games. I mean, I usually play and I play and then I get bored near the end, and I never seem to finish games. In the past couple months, I'm finishing games left and right because they're taking no time.
Yeah, and that really bugged me because I'm used to these games. Like I said, I get at least $1 per hour of entertainment out of my game. And also in Arkham Asylum, which I paid like $59.99 or something to that effect for, I have beaten with all the side quests in tops, absolute tops, 20 hours.
You know, and I could accept the argument if someone were to come and say, okay, yes, this is a short single player, but there's all this multiplayer and internet. But every game we're complaining about here, you know, and these are games we loved.
Yeah, I'm not.
I loved Infamous and I beat it in a week. But these aren't multiplayer games. No. There is multiplayer aspect, but it's the same story as a single player.
Yes, exactly. Well, in Arkham Asylum, there is no multiplayer.
Right. Infamous has no multiplayer.
You cannot play Arkham Asylum as Batman and Robin or Batman and Nightwing or even Blue Batman and Red Batman. There's only a one player game. You could compete against other people in the challenge modes. In Ultimate Alliance, you can play multiplayer, but it's only through the single-player campaign.
Right.
It's not like there is some separate multiplayer element like in a real-time strategy game.
Yeah, if it were just a giant map and we were connecting and trying to, you know, figure the best way to beat this map or something, that'd be one thing.
Right.
But it's the same story you did single-player.
You know, and when we first attempted to cover this topic in a prior episode that was actually lost recording because of technical issues, we were talking with Ed Healy, and as we were having this conversation, because he's really not that plugged into role-playing games, he looked up the rate of inflation.
You mean video games?
Did I say role-playing games?
Yes, okay. Because Ed Healy is incredibly plugged into role-playing games.
Okay, well, if you take role-playing games minus Jumbo Margarita, you get video games.
Gotcha.
So as we were recording that episode, he looked up, out of curiosity, what the total inflation of the dollar, the American dollar, has been.
Yeah, because I brought up the point, even though apparently I'm not supposed to talk anymore. I brought up the point.
Pat, what was Chad's point?
Yes.
His point was something very long-winded, on and on and on, and then he finally came around to it. By that time, everybody had forgotten what it was about in the first place. Nobody cared. Half the people had turned off, and they were wondering, why the hell isn't Pat saying something?
Because Pat sat there and looked thoughtful, and then, which carries over so well on the mics, He rubbed his chin thoughtfully, nodded a couple of times, and then looked over at the other person who was speaking.
And then made and a lot nodded. Of noise with the with ice in his Mountain Dew.
Oh, you know, I'm imitating Pat.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no ice in this.
Yeah, usually there's ice noises I have to edit out of the show to keep us from sounding like a total garage recording.
But they're fantastic.
Yeah, you know, hey.
All right, so Chad brings up the point.
I bring up the point that I remember when I bought Legend of Zelda, the classic Nintendo, back in the day.
Back when video games, the Babbages, which doesn't even exist anymore, were like $19.99 a pop.
Yeah, I bought
and
this
the
game.
The first video game that gave you the ability to save that we were able to come up with sitting around the table, at least.
I bought Legend of Zelda for $19.95 or $19.99, whatever it was, a $20 bill. Yeah. And at the time, I thought that was an outrageous extravagance to spend. Now, granted, I was a kid, and that took up a couple weeks' worth of allowance, so there was that perspective. But even still, I remember thinking $20 was a huge amount of money to pay for a video game. Now, we're dropping... How much did you spend for Arkham Asylum?
$60. Yeah, $60. $60
is pretty much the normal standard.
Wii is usually about $10 games. Cheaper than the others, but everything else is at least $60 these days.
Yeah. You'll occasionally find a video game for $50, but like these guys are saying, your typical video game, whether PC or Xbox or PS3 or whatever video game system you prefer, is $59.99.
Now, here's the question I brought up at that podcast and that I'm going to bring up again. Do you feel, now we're not talking a JRPG here, where you get 100 hours worth of play in it, because that's something that's inherent to that genre, so to speak, but I'm talking a typical game. Your average game lasts about somewhere between 5 to 10 hours. Do you get $60 worth of entertainment value out of that video game?
And the basic answer, I think, is no.
Yeah, I would say adamantly no in my case. I could rent the same game for $5, play it in 3 days. I wish I would have rented, but I wanted to pre-order just to get Juggernaut.
Well, precisely. Let's go to Arkham Asylum. If you rent it for a week, $5 divided by 20 hours, I mean, is what it is, a quarter an hour?
Yeah.
Versus $60.
You couldn't even get an hour out of a quarter in an arcade machine back in the day.
Yeah, and as opposed to $60 divided by, let's be just average here, let's say 15 hours, which is $4 an hour. And one of the things, as I started to say earlier, that Ed Healy looked up while we were recording this, was the inflation on the dollar since the mid-80s. And the inflation was 107%, which means that a video game today, instead of $19.99, should probably be $39.99. Not $59.99, but $39.99.
We also have to take into account that Legend of Zelda was probably designed by a handful of guys.
Yes.
And on a such-and-such computer, Grand Theft Auto has a huge...
And I had that question for you,
no
Dan.
No voice acting, blah, blah, blah.
As a developer... Does it take more work to create the games these days? Because back then, I know it's much smaller code, much less lines of code.
Much smaller.
Now you have more tools, like, for example, an engine.
World of
Warcraft.
You have
the Quake engine. You're building on top of already written code that they didn't have back then.
World of Warcraft is 5 million lines of code.
Well, and that's the inevitability is, okay, for anyone who's not supercomputer literate, when you type a letter on a computer, so you hit the A key and get the letter A, you have taken up 1 byte. Yeah. Okay. Now, when we talk about kilobytes, we're talking about 1,000 bytes, so 1,000 letters. When we talk about megabytes, we're talking about 1 million bytes or 1 million letters. So if you type in, let's say, 100,000-word novel with an average of 5 letters per word, and we'll include spaces in the word length, then you're probably talking about 500,000 bytes of information. Now, if we go back, the old classic video games are typically between about 40 and 70 kilobytes of size versus a modern day video game where you're measuring it in gigabytes. Now, granted, some of that's programming, but a lot of that is not programming. In fact, I think video games today, if you compare the number of options that you have and the number of actions you can perform in a typical video game today, I think it's actually less than the classic video games.
You're just talking gameplay-wise, not programming-wise.
Yes, gameplay-wise. What you have now is more sophisticated physics engines, ragdoll physics, graphics.
Procedural content.
Voice acting. Perhaps even some things that I'm really in favor of, like what they call emergent gameplay, which means gameplay that even the programmers couldn't predict.
I do emergent
now,
gameplay.
I'd like to see
every game I play.
I'd like to hear an example of this, because if you go back to, say, Super Mario Brothers,
okay,
you run, you jump, you have two buttons, that's all you need. Go forward to a game now, like, we'll use Marvel Ultimate Alliance just because we were playing it.
Okay.
You have four potential powers you can use. You have other attacks you can use. You're using quite a few more buttons. That would seem to mean that you have more options for what you're doing.
Fair enough. But did you ever play any of the classic PC games like...
Oh, that's a whole nother story. I would agree with that.
I think you're in a different realm, that's more what I'm alluding to, is things like Bard's Tale, Curse of the Azure Bond.
You have always had more choices Wasteland.
I don't know, because...
I don't think it's a fair comparison.
The original Unreal, not the shooter that everyone thinks of, but the original Unreal.
I think it's an unfair comparison.
Yeah, I agree.
If you take Civilization for the Xbox, which they had to dumb down to Civ Revolutions...
Yeah.
I'm not saying Civ Revolution is a good or bad game, because I've actually never played. The demo is sitting on my Xbox right now unplayed. But it's a far simpler game than Civ 4. With all the expansions.
Yeah, the bottom line is, back in the day, you had a full keyboard on a computer. Yeah. You have more buttons to potentially use. And I think that's one of the reasons why you didn't have more options in regular Nintendo and some of the older systems, is you didn't have the buttons, so they wouldn't give you the options. There's no way to trigger them.
Okay, well, fair enough, but let's compare, let's even stay within the same time frame, and compare Super Mario Brothers to Final Fantasy, the original. You still had the same number of buttons, yet you had a menu system. You had additional options.
Are you talking about a genre choice then? Because if you take...
Well, I'm not talking about anything in particular. My general...
Half-Life 2 is not as complex as Medieval 2,
right.
Total War. But they both have the same level of development. You know, Medieval 2 doesn't necessarily have the same story writing, because that's not what the game's about. But there's a genre difference that creates a total... And both of them are on the PC. And there's this huge genre difference.
Sticking in the same genre, I would say you had a lot more options in Final Fantasy VII than you did Final Fantasy.
Fair enough. But, I mean, my overall complaint really is not about the number of options.
It's that you're an old man and you want your old man games and you want them to be 90 hours. Which I think is fantastic. I think all games should be 90 hours.
All up and
I wanted to last more than a weekend for $60.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I don't want to spend $60 on a weekend of entertainment.
You know how they're making up for that? The excuse? Like Marvel Ultimate Alliance and all those? Sure, you get 8 hours worth of plot and gameplay, but your replayability, the $60, the value, online competitive play.
No, Marvel Ultimate Alliance doesn't have any of that.
Really?
Well, and all the games we're talking about, that's one of our big complaints, is that
online play.
It has online play, but it's co-op through the single-player story.
Through the main single-player plot.
You don't have different maps. You don't have a different story. Lame.
You don't even
there's
get
no
that value added.
Well, and even
bingo.
Like, even like with Ultimate Alliance, at least, you could potentially go back and play the same game over again with other characters. But again, it's still the same character, different characters. Arkham Asylum, if you replay it, it's just you're playing Batman again. Through the same game.
Yes.
Maybe you played on hard, but there's not really...
Exactly.
So those two are a good comparison. The fact that the replayability really is not there between...
A different example, let's use Dawn of War 2. The single player game is actually fairly lengthy. I really can't complain too much about the length of the single player.
It had an acceptable length for the price even I paid beyond for it, but I only paid $15 for it.
Yeah, so and even beyond the single player game, Chad, you and I a couple times have already met online to do some cooperative...
It was fun.
Skirmish games.
Yeah.
Not the single player plot, but a completely separate skirmish game that has nothing to do with the primary plot. Completely different scenarios. I think actually same. Well, no, some of them were new maps. Some of them were maps from the main game, but some of them were new maps. But something like Arkham Asylum or Ultimate Alliance 2 don't have that. Let me give you another example. Here in St. Louis, seeing a movie costs you about $9, which I've been told compared to most major cities is really freaking cheap. But if you go in to see a movie, stadium seating, all that jazz, you're going to pay about $9. Now, we love long movies. In fact, the traditional movie length going back like the 1980s of 90 minutes really is no longer acceptable anymore. Most people want a two and a half hour movie. But if I went in to see a movie and I put down my $9 and the movie was 15 minutes long, you'd be outraged.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, maybe I've just been spoiled by RPGs. And I don't mean tabletop RPGs. I mean electronic RPGs. Maybe I've just been spoiled by those. But when I play through a game like Batman, and I've beaten it in like 3 days. And I don't mean 3 days of continuous play. I mean 3 days of playing this on the side when I have free time.
Yeah, and like I said, for Marvel Ultimate Alliance, 3 days, I worked two of them.
Yeah, and it's that's pretty outrageous to me that I dropped $60 only to get such minimal gameplay. And I suppose people out there that use services like Gamefly or Blockbuster or something to rent their games are probably smarter than I am. Because
why don't you guys rent?
I do rent some. In this case, you know, Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, I wanted Juggernaut. But I do rent
and
some.
To explain that, you had to pre-order from GameStop to unlock Juggernaut, who was stupid, broken, powerful.
Which I have no complaint about that. I like the fact that he was, you know, incredibly overpowered compared to every other character because I pre-ordered to get him.
Yeah.
And that justifies, in my mind, the pre-order.
Oh, and I love Juggernaut. I mean, even the popular internet meme aside, I love Juggernaut. I've always thought he was a neat character. And so, same thing here. I pre-ordered from GameStop and got Juggernaut, and he's stupid, broken, powerful, and I have no problem with that. I'm just being honest about the fact that he's stupid, broken, powerful. But, in fact, if I loan the game to anybody, I may give them sufficient information to log into my live account.
Actually, the last I heard, you can put anything in the code, and it works. There's like some sort of bug on the website.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
funny.
There was some sort of bug on the website. Yeah. Didn't your wife, Wayne, when she was frustrated trying to get to work, she put in, I hate GameStop as the code, and it gave her a Juggernaut code?
Not that I would have normally admitted that on the air, but yeah, she did.
Cool.
We didn't use that code anyway.
Wow.
We actually had to call Activision because the whole pre-order system was incredibly bad and failed.
By the way, FYI, don't ever pre-order anything from GameStop. I've pre-ordered countless things from them, and I have taken it up the butt every single time. This is the first time and only time it worked out for me.
Service they provided.
Maybe there's a service they're providing there.
Boy, they're really including a lot of special extras with these pre-orders lately.
This is the first time in a long time I've pre-ordered anything from GameStop and not been screwed. So,
but you got screwed by the game. It's only 5 hours long.
Well, I mean, not quite that bad, but yeah. If you're speaking facetiously, then yeah. That's, you know, I tell you, the best entertainment for your dollar is still a tabletop role-playing game.
Infinite. I thought it would be hookers and blow.
No, because even then you're paying a lot per hour.
Personally, hookers don't last very long.
And, yeah, saying blow no, come down eventually.
No, neither do you guys.
No,
for
you
that
got
matter.
It's the other way around. You got that reverse.
I'm not
Wayne.
Disappointed.
That's right.
So let's talk about role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games, or, you know, the thing that shows.
No, I want you guys to bitch about Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 for another 20 minutes.
Hey, Chad.
But we've already...
Shh. Oh, wait. I'll rub my chin thoughtfully.
That's better.
Mm.
But
nod.
See, we already
there
bitched about it.
And this make is me some doing ice pat. Noise that I'm I'll nodding. Have to edit out of the show later.
This we already bitched about pat. It last week, so now that we've nod. Done it again, it just doesn't have the same vigor.
Uh-huh. Nod.
Yeah.
So here's nod. What I want to talk about in terms of tabletop role-playing games this week. We still have some thoughts on one-shot games I'll come back to eventually, but not right now. But what I want to talk about is something that Chad and I have discussed in the past, but not just Chad. I've discussed this with a couple people.
Rutabagas?
You're just looking for a place to insert that.
I thought it was spreadsheets.
You're just now getting that?
No. I'm just calling a spade a spade.
Well, yeah. That's the whole point.
And incidentally,
I hate you so much.
In case anyone thinks the phrase call a spade is racist, because
you did this on one of the previous episodes.
The racist implications of spade, I found my book of cliches in their history.
Good for you. That's good awesome.
Yeah, that is very good.
Stop kissing his ass, Chris.
Well, he's saying that because
he's
saying that because he's taking off his headphones and he's tied. He's probably got about 5 minutes before he has to come back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Calling a spade, to speak plainly, to avoid euphemism. Tell it like it is. This actually comes from the ancient Greeks, who had a similar expression. As the dramatist Menander put it, I call a fig, a spade, or as Plutarch records, the Macedonians are a rude and clownish people that call a spade. I won't read the rest of it, but
thank God
it is not a racist saying. And I actually bring that up because there was a lady here in St. Louis who in the middle of a city council meeting blew up because some guy said, I'm going to call a spade. And she's like, that's racist. And it's like, no, you're uneducated. That's
what about black as the ace of spades? How's that fall?
What?
That's under the Motorhead list.
I'll let you look that up. Look I'm going to push all the episodes. But Chad, we were talking about something related to tabletop role-playing games, which is the lack of mythology within most fantasy role-playing games.
I don't believe it.
You haven't even heard
excellent.
It.
Excellent. No, no. Excellent. You're absolutely right.
Why do you not believe it, Chris?
No, what? No, I'm just making a joke. You're talking about lack of mythology, and I'm saying I don't believe it.
Yep. Get it? Get it?
Mythology, beliefs.
Chris is old.
God, you guys suck today.
No, I totally got it, Chris. All right, I thought you that guys, was humorous for an old man.
Or Pat, whoever you are being, suck.
Chris is on it tonight. He's on fire.
That's the first time I've spoken in 25 minutes.
I was sitting there trying to swallow my tongue during the Ultimate Alliance wank off, thinking, man, I wish I was Chris, because I could be sitting there right now with no pants and tons of lube with 20 minutes on my hands.
Here's one for you, Chad. Separating the sheep from the goats.
Okay. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I would presume that one's biblical, but
it actually is, yeah. Because it's right under separating the men from the boys, which, you know, you've heard that one. That makes sense. And then you've got separating the sheep from the goats for the other crowd.
So, anyway, I want to approach the...
You know, Pat, now it is my turn to say, I love you. You're just so... I don't know where you are tonight or what exactly you're doing, but I'm loving it either way.
That's right. I love it, too. Now that we've settled our hash, we can get on with the episode.
The book needs to be burned.
No.
And I don't say that about very many books.
Thank you, Adam Hartz, my brother-in-law. This is the greatest gift I've ever been given. Next to Unicron, which I bought for myself. It wasn't a gift, so f*** you to everyone that didn't buy me Unicron. But anyway, there are two angles I want to approach this particular issue from, lack of mythology and role-playing game. And, you know, I think rather than list them and then deal with them, I'm going to deal with them as I list them. So part one, and let's deal with this, is part of the problem with fantasy settings, they lack mythology because everything is real.
Yes. Now, you can't have a pantheon of gods that aren't really real.
Yeah.
But there's a pantheon of gods and all the related stuff that goes with them. If you have a different pantheon of gods that's right there.
Yeah.
They're there. The guy who's on fire and 50 feet tall and killing millions of people. God. Well, he is a god.
Or even if not the god himself, his clerics are casting spells that have real and undisputable results. In fact, I want to actually throw in a word that was brought up that's not in my notes, but I think better describes the lack of what's going on here, which is superstition.
Yeah.
People debate the meaning of the word myth like they debate the meaning of the word role-playing game. It's semantic masturbation. I mean, it just gets ridiculous. So let's maybe even use the word superstition. But the point is that because of the fact that they know there are things about the world they don't know, but you don't know what you don't know, and so you can't really say for sure what's real and what's not real. And so there's this sense of mystery. But let's face it, particularly in high fantasy, and I'm going to separate high fantasy from mid fantasy from low fantasy, and we'll talk about that. But particularly in high fantasy, it's really hard to put any sense of mythology, because if somebody talks about the dragon, that dragon's really there.
Yeah.
If somebody talks about this ancient goddess who's long been forgotten, that ancient goddess either really is there or really was there.
Yeah.
One of the two. There is no sense that when you hear about something, okay, fair enough. If you've got a good game master, they may throw in some false rumors at the end.
But that's
a rumor to an individual from an individual. Society as a whole is not holding on to Heracles/Hercules.
Yeah.
You're not holding on to these types and shadows and images that have no correspondence with reality, where the player characters, when you approach them and say there's a dragon over the hill, their first in-character legitimate response is, that's probably not true.
Yeah.
Their first in-character response is, wow, there's a dragon over the hill, so I'm going to switch from my plus two sword to my plus one slash plus three versus dragon sword, because there's a dragon.
Or can't the characters like say, hey, there's a dragon over the hill, but there's really no dragon, and the characters believe it? That's another thing. I'd say not just the characters, but the players.
Even more than the characters, the players.
Yeah.
Do they ever hit a point of disbelief?
Okay, so my question for you is, what's the problem with that? And what's the problem with there being a lack of mythology?
Well, yeah, and I completely agree with what I think Pat's getting at here is, in a world where these things really exist, why would they have myth? In a world where you have these over-the-top people, you really have your Hercules. Why would you need to create Hercules 2 over there? Because this one really exists.
I'm going to concede right up front, I guess maybe not right up front, but 15 minutes into the topic, that in high fantasy, this is not an issue, this will not be an issue, and this should not be an issue for the reasons you guys just stated. If you exist in a world where wizards are riding around atop Pegasi, throwing fireballs at gods and goddesses, then the need for myth in this regard, we'll get to a second regard here in a little bit, but in this first regard of superstition or things people believe that don't actually exist, despite her ravings, the gypsy can't actually put a hex on you because she has no such power. That kind of thing is irrelevant. It only becomes relevant if you're playing mid or low fantasy.
And I think even in mid or low fantasy, you know, I'll get back to my original example. What's the point of having a pantheon of gods that's not really real when you have a pantheon of gods that is real? You would just believe in the real gods because they're there and they're, they're clerics
the
are casting
average,
spells and stuff. And
that, the average
that's
myth
fine.
Or superstition became basically came into being because people needed to answer a question.
Well,
but you don't need to answer that question if you actually have a god that says, yep, did that.
And as I was saying, though, that's fine on that high level. But when you start getting down to the individual level, onto a lower, you know, sort of baseline level of society, when we're not talking about gods and we're not talking about the big stuff, we're not talking about the Hercules, we're not talking about the pantheon of gods, we're not talking about the mythical dragon, be, you know, here be monsters and you don't really know, but there really are because this is D&D or whatever. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with hand-waving that on many different levels of fantasy and saying, yes, those things are really there. But my issue starts really coming in on the second point that Dan and I are coming around to making. Say you had a witch in real history, in the medieval times on Earth, and it's not a game, you know, a pagan witch in medieval Europe.
1000 AD.
Yeah, 1000 AD, 1300, whatever. That witch believed that she can cast spells. Now, she obviously wasn't sitting there with this Vancian spell system and going over her spell list and stuff. It was the art or the craft or whatever you want to call it. But he or she thought that they could do A, B, and C. And that A, B, and C did something. It was paranormal and it was a mystery and it was unexplained. When you start getting into fantasy, when you start getting into these games, suddenly two things happen. One, you start explaining these things. You know how it works. And then two, they really do happen. And I think that a lot of fantasy...
Well, on the stress point number two, there is no debate over whether they happen.
And that's where I've got a question, though. Well, are we on point two yet?
Well, actually,
apparently I talk too much, so maybe I'm explaining
Chad's
it
Chad's point
long,
two but... is actually different than my point two, so we're on point, I don't know, 1.5 or 0.3. But go on, Chris.
Well, no, I guess my question for what you're going at is, what's your threshold for that stuff to exist? I mean, are you talking about Podunk Village knows and has experienced, you know, magic on any level, you know, versus obviously your big metropolises, your water deeps or your Greyhawk cities or whatever that have, you know, magic is active in the streets. I'm just wondering, you know, when you go at this for what you're saying, are you looking at a certain threshold for this? Because it would seem to me that regardless of what level of fantasy, high, medium, or low, which you haven't necessarily defined yet, but it would seem to me that even in high fantasy, in the smallest of villages, you're not necessarily going to find people who, sure, they've heard of magic and they've heard that this kind of stuff happens. They've heard that monsters and maybe a wizard lives in some mysterious tower 2 days away, but odds are most of these villagers had never been 2 days away. So it would still be mythological to them.
Okay, well, hold on a second here, Chris, because I think your statement of threshold is something of a straw man. And the reason I say that is because let's say we take low fantasy. And to answer your question, you said we hadn't really defined these. By high, medium, and low fantasy, and I'm sure someone who's going to debate this, there's no lack of pedantic people in the role-playing community, us included. But to define those terms, I am talking about the prevalence and irrefutable provability of things like gods, goddesses, magic, whatever. All right, I'm talking about how common those are. In a high fantasy setting, every town has its wizard. There's probably three in your party. You're just as likely to pick up an enchanted spoon as a regular one. To low fantasy, which is the far opposite extreme, where the vast majority of people have never really actually seen anything paranormal. There's just stories, and there's a creepy guy on the hill who claims he can put hexes on people. And the last time he did, the guy broke his arm. But it's not like there's any real clear parallel where his arm just broke. Yes, something happened. He slipped and fell in the field. Could just be coincidence. Could be real. We don't really know.
It could be the mythology you're saying isn't in the game.
Possibly so. But I think with threshold, you're setting a straw man on that you're tying the threshold to the population of a town. Because the fact is, let's say even in the lowest of fantasy settings, there is a guy who can, for real, open his palm and throw forth a fireball.
Can break the laws of
physics.
He
can break the laws of physics and do something that is preternatural, if not outright supernatural. The fact is, this could be done in a town of 5 people or a town of 5 million people. I don't think the size of the town has anything to do with the nature of the fantasy or the nature of the mythology.
Now, I would disagree with that because I say, if there's only so many people that are likely to know how to do that, the higher population of people, the more likely you're going to have somebody in there.
Precisely, but when you're saying, particularly in a low fantasy setting, that maybe only a handful of people in the entire world can do it, where they choose to do it now becomes an anecdote and not a cultural norm. Now, what you are describing, at least what it sounds like to me, whether this is where you're going or not, is the type of game that I prefer to run, which is a mid-fantasy game, where you don't have every town has 20 wizards riding around Pegasi shooting rainbows out their asses. But what you do have is every major town might have a sage, who in D&D terms is a first through third level wizard who can create basic potions and cast low-level spells for a fee, where magical weapons are out there, people know they exist, but not everybody and their dog has one, as opposed to a low fantasy where there's only one plus one sword in the entire world versus a high fantasy where you just throw plus one swords away because they're not even worth keeping. And I'm simplifying the issue, but you get the idea.
Yeah. Well, one of the points that I was trying to make earlier on was with the witch. You know, you have the witch, and she thinks she can do all this stuff. She can spoil the milk and kill the unborn child in the belly and cause ruin and give warts and
right.
All that sort of stuff. You have this sort of mythology or the superstition that goes on in real history where people believed this. And there were reasons why they believed it. You know, there were explanations that were not accurate explanations of how things worked and how life worked to explain things that weren't happening anyway. And it was this sort of, it's this tapestry of society that in fantasy games is completely and utterly missing.
Well, and I think, though, even if you allow for those things, you can have a different kind of game. Now, I'm not bashing.
Why is it that in a fantasy game, the wizard who can bend space-time and physics and do all this crazy stuff, why does he have to know exactly how everything works? Why can't he do something and then give his the story, so to speak, gives the explanation of, well, this is how this works, and they're wrong.
I have the question for you. Why can't they? Let's say the rules say specifically, you know, you are invoking this god. Why can't you, if you're the player that wants to do this, you can just say, I think this works because I am calling on the mystical element of fire. That's all on you and how you want to play your character.
I agree. And I do that in every single fantasy game I play.
Exactly. Well, there's nobody stopping that, though, is what I'm saying.
You're stopping me. You're putting me down, Wayne. Gary Gygax is going to rise from the dead, come to my house, and break my kneecaps for not playing D&D his way.
I'd pay money to watch that, by the way.
Actually, I think Gary
I would record that and I would put that on YouTube.
I think Gary Gygax would totally agree with you based on past things he said where, I mean, we're talking the father of D&D and he has said stuff like, I can't quote anything here, but basically the gist of it is this is just the framework. However you want to play it out, go for it.
Yeah, a rule system sets up how you do this mechanically.
Right. Well, I'm just talking
fluff
like
is you.
I'm not just talking the fluff of the characters because my thing is I think people should put this more in characters. It interests me. If you don't want to do it, fine, whatever. I'm just talking fantasy in general. I see this all the time in role-playing games because I see it all the time in novels.
Though, you know what this reminds me of? Is the first time that I played Ravenloft, not the module, but the campaign setting.
The module's awful, by the way.
I know. But I'm talking about the campaign setting. And one of the things that the game master I was playing under really played up in the setting was the fact that nobody was exactly clear how things operated. It's that sense of mystery, though, that for a player created something neat. Because you have somebody who's the witch on a hill or the gypsy in the caravan claiming they can hex you. And it is a flip of a coin.
Whether they could or couldn't.
Whether they could or couldn't.
And that's really cool. And
that created a fear. Because the thing is, if you know the boundaries, there's nothing to fear. Because while they may be powerful, you know precisely how it operates and whether they're capable of what they claim. But when you don't know, because this person could just be a nut.
Yeah.
Or, quite frankly, they really could put a spell on you to where for the next 2 years, you have a minus 10 to every roll you make because they've hexed you.
Or you're a superstitious rube, and whether they can or can't is irrelevant. You believe them.
Yes.
See, to me, that needs to be in more fantasy because there's no mystery in fantasy. It's like living in today's world almost. We know how biology works. We know how physics, there's obvious
experience. We're still in the process.
Broad brushes.
Okay, right, why do you feel that fantasy is not in role-playing games? What's making you say it's not in there? It's obviously not an issue with the books because you don't need to explain in a rule book that something doesn't work.
Why not?
If something doesn't work, it just doesn't work. You don't need to roll dice to say that something...
I'm going to presume to take Chad's point here, and Chad can correct me if I'm wrong, but, I guess keep it simple. Let me defend this from my own point. I think it adds mystery to the world when you don't know. And if you define to the player what really is going on by something called disjunctive syllogism, you have also defined what isn't going on. And what you have done thereby is removed any sense of mystery or wonderment or fear from the world. Now, I want to stress, I'm not saying this is necessary in all fantasy games. If you want to run a traditional D&D game, a high fantasy game, there is nothing wrong with that, and you don't need this kind of mystery. But if you wanted to run a game, let's say, in medieval Earth, but you want to bend reality enough to accept that magic and religion, and I realize I'm not meaning to step on toes here. Whatever your views are, I'm not trying to step on your toes. But you're willing to accept within your game that the prayers of a holy man or the curses of a witch can actually do something, but not consistently. I want to be careful of this word, but not vulgarly so. And what I mean by that is she may not be able to throw lightning bolts from her fingertips, but if the witch puts a curse or a blessing on you, that maybe the DM is actually going to be putting a +2 or -2 on all your rolls for a while and not even telling you about it. And you don't know which witch is nuts versus really has the power. Yeah. And which prophecies are true versus which prophecies are just some guy who's getting high off of gases in a cave making crap up. And I think that adds a wonderful level of detail and wonderment to the players, not even the characters, but to the players, that is not there in a setting where everything is in your face as being true or false, right or wrong.
And it just seems to me that in fantasy role-playing games that I have played in, role-playing settings that I've read, books that I have read, novels that have nothing to do with role-playing games that I've read their fantasy, there is no mystery. Fantasy is stuck in a rut. Well, I mean, it's stuck in a lot of ruts because it's kind of that Tolkien thing, and you know why, I think that is though.
I don't think it's a rut. I think it is that most game books, with there are exceptions like user manuals, most game books are written for the GM as a tool.
Sure,
the GM needs to know how these mechanics are going to work,
and he needs to know the fluff and
right.
all that stuff.
And I think that's why that is. It's not a matter of being stuck in a rut. Well, although I'm not arguing they're not stuck in a rut.
Here's the thing: what happens from that? And I'm not saying you're wrong. You're absolutely right. Actually, I totally agree with you. But what happens from that is that the characters, and I'm not even saying the players, because the players are playing their characters as the game intends them to be played. The characters go into this world knowing everything about how the clockwork works, how the clockwork of the world works, where they know how the magic works. They know why this works. They know why their gods give them spells. They know why this works. They know why the dragons are there. They know that dragons are there, and everything's fine. They don't know the intricacies of the plot, how this army is moving across the land.
They know
this setting.
Well, let me ask Pat a question, because he's doing a terrible chat impression. He's back to his thinking man pose.
He's been nodding thoughtfully. You have this very thoughtful look that doesn't translate to a podcast.
Pat, yeah, I've been thoughtful on what you
before
guys have
been
saying.
Before I get on to my point, too, about the lack of mythology in a role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that occurred when we were playing Ravenloft under this GM the first time was he had a rule, which at the time I thought was kind of nonsensical. Today I backed off from quite such a harsh opinion, but I still kind of rolled my eyes at a little bit.
We were teenagers. We could roll our eyes.
Yeah.
I'm sure our characters were crap too.
They were. He said that basically if we ever bought the Ravenloft setting books, he would no longer run the game for us anymore. The reason being, because now we would know what in the setting was real versus unreal. Now, as Chad just described, and as Wayne described, part of what goes into a role-playing game is, particularly for the GM or DM, you have to explain what's real and how things really work, so they can have some degree of consistency in the world, presuming you're selling a setting and not just a generic rules book.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said quite specifically, in order to maintain that level of superstition and fear and lack of knowledge, I will only run this game as long as you guys don't know the truth about the setting. And the moment you know that truth, I will no longer run this game. What do you think of something like that?
Well, I think that falls in line somewhere along the lines of, like, when I first started playing D&D, you quickly learn, well, you've got your player's handbook, and that's fine for you to read, but you can't read the Dungeon Master's Guide, because that's for the Dungeon Master to have, and that's whatever else like that, so you stay away from that. I think it's kind of like that, and it's a little bit different than that. And I guess I see what he was getting at in trying to keep the mythos of it out there.
Right.
But I kind of would have rolled my eyes at it too. I don't think it needs to be that way. In a published campaign. Now, that being said, on along those lines, my longstanding campaign that I bring up every now and again, basically it was a homebrew setting. It was sort of like the Danverse. It was the PW verse, we'll call it.
Okay.
Because he made it up. And I feel that I had an experience very much like what you were saying that you would want.
Uh-huh.
Basically, this, I would call what we were in, it would be a low-medium fantasy setting.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, it was rare, and it was, you know, you think of it literally, like just like you the example you've given, think medieval Earth type of a world with a little bit of bend the laws. You've got your magic, you've got your multi-gods, whatever.
That's the kind of fantasy I tend to like too.
Right. And so, but what we had going for us is the mythos was there because we were learning about this world while we were playing. I didn't sit down with PW beforehand and say, okay, hit me with everything. I want to go from
the creation to where we are today, and I want to know everything, and then we'll start playing. That's not what happened. I mean, we just started playing, and I'm learning as I'm going. And I had a paladin, so I was the, you know, the religiously type, so we had that covered. But as far as magic goes, I was learning about it through the magic characters in our party. And like the whole dragon thing, I think there was a dragon that I think we may have encountered at some point, you know, in the time of play. But for us, that was sort of like a legend. It was a mythos because, like, well, we've heard about these things in the past, but no one's seen them.
And isn't that so
whatever.
Cool?
And it was great.
Isn't that so cool that the character, even if the players know, the characters think that, we'll take the example of a dragon, is something out of myth, something out of legend. And there's debate. Scholars say this thing could never exist. And then the old crone warns you never to go into the hills because children go there and disappear. And you see smoke rising in the middle of the night. Oh, that's just you don't understand. But then you actually encounter one, and they're real, and it's like, wow.
So you can get it. I mean, we had it. Yeah. I had a great experience with that. So.
And I think that my problem with fantasy is, while there is that to a very, very small degree, there isn't enough. There isn't enough mystery.
And I see what you're saying, and so that's my experience with my campaign, and I loved it. So I'm with you on that page, but as a sort of a counterpoint to what you guys are sort of talking about, is I look at it as this. I'm playing this game. I am playing a fantasy game because I want to experience something that I don't experience in real life. I've got plenty of this, say, mythology or the mystery or whatever in real life because this stuff doesn't exist, period. So I'm playing this game where I expect it to be there. And so that's fine. I mean, that's sort of what you're doing. You know, especially in a high fantasy game, what there is no mystery. It is what it is. Yeah. I'm trying to experience this, much like, you know, when you can like it even to the console games. I mean, you buy a game like Marvel Ultimate Alliance because you want to play superheroes. And that's
Pat,
what you're going
let
for.
Let me say that I have the utmost sympathy for where you're coming from. And I suppose I should clarify that when I talk about the lack of wonderment or superstition in a role-playing game, generally, what I'm talking about is this. When I sit down to play a science fiction game, I want capital ships and powered armor and machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
When I sit down to play a fantasy game, depending on the type of fantasy game, I may want something different.
Okay? Sure.
So I have no problem with you saying, I want to sit down and escape reality into Middle Earth or into Narnia or into Forgotten Realms or whatever and experience. There are wizards on every street corner and everybody has a magic sword. I don't have a problem with that. But let me give an example for my own gaming history.
When I play fantasy, I want Little Red Riding Hood. And that's not a joke.
I understand. You're interested in legend and lore and things like fables.
Well, I guess the big thing is you're not playing an everyday person in most of these games. You're playing someone who is larger than life. The Little Red Riding Hood, you are the Little Red Riding Hood. It's your story that people are going to be telling generation after generation you're doing that larger than life.
What I'm getting at
thing.
With how I want, what I want Little Red Riding Hood as is that I want normal people who are superstitious, but you live in this world of the unknown and of the mystery where there are things out there, but you don't know what those things are. And they're so much more powerful than you, but you interact with them. It isn't just there's the boogeyman and he grabs you and eats you and you kill him. But not only can you interact with him, like in Little Red Riding Hood, you as a normal person, not as a heroic figure, can overcome the darkness. What I want out of fantasy.
I don't want to dig into politics, but I want to draw an analogy from politics, which is one of the things they've talked about changing in modern politics, particularly with the advent and popularity of the internet, is the level of information that the average voter has at their fingertips. Whether it's accurate or inaccurate, whatever, I don't care. I'm not trying to get into that. This is not the show for that. But
Fear the Politics is at www.fearthepolitics.com.
Right, and if there's something out there, whatever it is, we have nothing to do with it, and you're free to do whatever you like over there. But my point being, there is a radical difference between the voter today as opposed to the voter 100 years ago or 200 years ago or even 25 years ago. And I would say the same thing is true of the role player though it's occurred much more quickly. There was a day when all you had was the player's handbook, and the DM's guide and the setting books were off limits to you. As opposed to now, where the average role player wants to and expects to be much more informed about the boundaries of the settings they're playing. Now, one of the coolest moments that I remember in my entire over 20 years of role-playing was we were playing a Skies of Glass game years ago. This was not in our recent campaign. This was back in its original iteration in the mid-90s. And there was a point, I think I've mentioned this story on Fear the Boot before, where Tim was playing a character, and Tim goes down into the sewers, and while he's down there, he's kind of creeping around through the filth of the sewers, and all of a sudden the skeleton's arm reaches around his neck and basically says, "Drop your weapon and give me your stuff." Now, the issue here was not amongst the characters. It was amongst the players. There was a side conversation amongst the players of, is there magic in Skies of Glass? Are there undead in Skies of Glass?
You know, we actually had a conversation kind of like that, even in the more recent game. It was at what level of sci-fi are we dealing with?
Yeah.
Are there robots in Skies of Glass? We had that conversation.
Yeah, it wasn't magic, it was robots. It was a similar conversation. But the players, because the fact is, you can role play to a certain extent. But what you cannot role play is what you, the real human being, is actually feeling. And everyone sitting around this table, actually, it was couches around a coffee table, but point being, everyone sitting around there was in genuine shock of, is there magic in this game? Has Dan written undead into this game and not mentioned it to us? And nobody knew. And so Tim's character, no longer certain what he was facing, panicked and complied. Well, it turned out later what he had actually been dealing with was there was a bandit who had made a puppet of a skeleton's arm and was using it to scare people who didn't know better. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that if Tim had known that, no amount of role-playing could have recreated the emotion that was occurring around that table.
Because pulled the Brothers Grimm on him.
Yes, exactly. Nobody knew exactly for sure where I was going to draw the lines. Now let me move on to the second subject. This is going to be a long show as it is, and that's fine. I don't care. Because, like I said, feartheboot.com may go down for a week anyway, so we'll let you get your fill now. The second subject I want to cover while we're on this show is the lack of detail in the mythology. Here's what I mean. I can't tell you the name of the book off the top of my head, so I don't have the book handy. I probably should have grabbed it for recording, but I didn't, man. Hey, what you going to do?
Sue?
Yeah, you can sue me. I'll give you a complete refund of everything you've paid to download Fear the Boot up to this point. But one of the greatest books that I think was ever put out for D&D was a second edition book for the Forgotten Realms that explained in detail each of the religions. Now, I'm not talking about the power pools and spells you can pick from or what your deity's preferred weapon is. That's surface peripheral crap. I'm talking about festivals, holidays, daily practices, sacraments, their views on the afterlife. It spelled those out in great detail. I realize our previous topic really only applied to medium and low fantasy. It really didn't apply to high fantasy. But this is something that I think applies to any level of fantasy and is a real disappointment of mine. Is that there is a lack of detail to the mythos of the world. That you may get a sense that this deity, okay, here's his or her portfolio, and here's where they fall in the pecking order, and here's the god or goddess they report to, and the god or goddesses that report to them, and here's their preferred weapon, and these are the power pools I can pick from. But you don't really have a sense of what their sacraments, their holidays, their scripture, the kinds of things. You know what? I have taught in churches for years. I have never thrown a fireball. All right, I'm just going to tell you this up front in case anyone's wondering. As much as I wish I had, I've never thrown a fireball. I did see a guy throw a fireball once, and he did it using a Bic lighter and actually set his hair on fire in the process, and it was really damn funny.
There's a time when people would have thought that was magic.
He did it in the middle of a calculus class, and we thought it was magic, but not for the reasons you may think. But my point being that there is no detail given to the mythology of the gods, the goddesses, the witch who lives on the hill, the gypsy caravan, the dragon that haunts yonder mountains. There is no detail given to that.
Sometimes and there is.
Sometimes, yes, well, yes. I'm painting with an intentionally broad and undiscriminating
brush. I've noticed that more so than there never is, I think that they will, like, you can pick up a role-playing game book and it might have festivals, but nothing else. Or it might have, this is what vestments of a religion wear, and then nothing else that goes that deep into it. It's all history and stories. Well, it's 5 pages of history and story, 500 pages of charts, weapons, and rules on how to kill people.
Right. You know my reaction to that, Dan? Basically, when I hear you describe it, I think, yeah, it'd be really cool to have all of those resources ready and available for a world when playing a game. But if your players get a hold of that, you know, that's a lot of information to have memorized. Wouldn't you rather create that world yourself?
Yes, but here's the thing. If I'm choosing to play in a pre-established setting, for example, Forgotten Realms, the last Forgotten Realms game I ran, it was a great resource because there was a guy that was serving the god of suffering, whose name now completely evades me. Not suffering as in torment, but suffering as in like the self-suffering messiah. And his name completely evades me. If I had my resources in front of me, I could...
Ah, see, you need your resources.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But the point being, would be a really handy resource to have.
I think, actually, the book I had was pre-Time of Troubles, and that god appears post-Time of Troubles. But I was able to draw from some other stuff and say, here's the kinds of things that you need to observe. All right, for anyone that's lived under a rock for the past lifetime, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, the teachings of Compassionate Buddha, these are long books. There's lots of stuff that goes into these religions. Even if you want to get out of religion and go into para-religions, okay, magical practices, occultism, the last time I saw, and the last run that I saw of Gale Research's Encyclopedia of Parapsychology and Occultism, it was 3 massive volumes in length. There's a lot that goes into this. Now, I accept that in a role-playing game, I cannot expect somebody to write 2,000 pages on every religion that they have in their game. But
why not? Well, not 2,000. No, I understand that.
Why can't I not expect more? I am expecting more. Yeah. That's my point.
The bottom line is you'd never get it into the game anyway.
Well, why not?
Well,
again.
At least as a supplement.
I'm not talking about 2,000 or 3,000 pages, but I'm talking Shadowrun. Shadowrun had one of the greatest resources ever, the Neo-Anarchist Guide to North America.
Well, and that's...
Not a single rule in there.
That's where I would go. Is what I would say is your basic role-playing game sourcebook, in my mind, should present the highest level of the world. Mm-hmm. And what you should be allowed to do through supplements is to pick the things that interest you and not imbalance the game a la
the
Fighter's Handbook or the Psionics Handbook or any of the countless abortions from TSR. But I'm talking about you decide that this religion interests you, or if it's science fiction, this race interests you, and you can drill down and pick up a book that really explains what that group is like. I know
This is where I think technology would really come in handy for something like this. Say you have a couple of books that are published, however you want, print, PDF, I don't care. But then as a business model, you can have somebody pay $5 and they get a login to a wiki?
To a wiki, yeah, exactly.
That is
exactly
really heavily detailed.
That really explains.
Always updating.
For this race or this religion, here's the culture, here's the practices, here's the holidays, mm-hmm. here's really what's going on. Once again, not dealing with what, in terms of magic, is real or not real or how it works. But this is what these people believe. This is what these people do. These are the precepts these people hold to that go beyond a simple portfolio of, yes, we love the morning and beauty. And therefore, this is beautiful and well, morning, so I'm going to love it.
This race lives here. They make this money through agriculture. They worship these gods. Their army is this big. They tend to produce wizards, clerics, and low-level fighters.
And if you play someone from that race, you get a +1 to your intelligence and a -1 to your dexterity. But something that really drills down and helps you roleplay that out.
Pet's making great facial expressions again.
I know.
He's like punctuating each point you make with a facial feature.
If this was a vidcast, we'd be cutting to Pat's expression of the moment. And the listener, or the watcher in that case,
yes,
might find it informative. But the fact is right now they're not, because Pat's not saying a damn thing.
Even nodding about us talking about him.
Yeah. Well, Pat, say something.
It's uncanny, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. No, it's not uncanny. It's a waste of everybody's time and investment in loving you. Yeah. You know what? You messed up a poll. There was a listener, and I mentioned this on the Kicked in the Dice.
Another great expression.
Yeah.
Fat's like,
He shakes his head and shrugs and says nothing. There was a listener in our forums. I think I mentioned this on the episode I did with Kicked in the Dice Bags. And if you've not heard about that, check the blog post. I explain that, give warnings, and also give a link to it. When I was doing that, I talked about a poll that a listener started on everybody's least favorite and most favorite host. There's two separate polls. And his theory setting out and doing this was that Chad was going to be the number one in both because he's such a divisive and boisterous character. And what messed up his poll was you, Pat, because everyone picked you as their least favorite host and went on to explain the reason I don't like Pat is because he never talks.
Mm-hmm.
Not because when he does talk.
Yeah, in fact, they said when he does talk, he's great.
Yeah.
And you are.
You wrecked that poll because you ended up as the number one least favorite host, and everyone posted and wrote out their reason for picking you was because he doesn't say anything.
Way to go, idiot.
Yeah, well, you know.
You know, Chad and I have a theory on this, actually. Chad and I think that what he does is, as we get into the conversations, he's sitting there and he's processing everything we're saying, mm-hmm, and he's preparing his response. So what we think we need to do is, when we come up with a topic like this and we start seeing the facial expressions, he gets asked first thing,
okay,
before he has a chance to formulate his opinion.
Well, I can't ask him first
thing
because it's too late, but I will ask him last thing.
Okay.
Pat, I think we've beaten the subject to death from a variety of angles. So I want you to give us the closing thought on anything we have just said over the past hour or 45 minutes or however long we've been talking about this. I don't know what the edited length will be.
Again, just to sort of say what I said before, a big part of the role playing is to experience something that you don't experience in everyday life. You know, it sort of is the escapism. And
right,
you're right with what you said about it, is that's sort of secondary to the issue that we were really talking about tonight. And I did play in my longstanding campaign. I played in a perfect example of what you are saying that you want to see more of. Of the mystery and everything else like that. I guess what it really gets down to is,
well, just to be clear, quick interruption. Just be clear.
Okay.
I'm not saying
I'm trying to talk.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk
shut
again
the whole time, man. I was listening.
This is a quick thought. I'm not saying I want to see more of. I'm just offering as an alternate possibility.
Okay.
Continue.
Gotcha. But I think what it really gets down to is, it is sort of incumbent upon the GM to sort of facilitate this and to work with it. Like, especially nowadays, it's going to come from a homebrewed campaign or something that's just not publicized. If your group wants to play in Lord of the Rings, you're not going to get the mystery. Everybody and their brother knows what to expect and what they want to see in, you know, Lord of the Rings,
right,
or a Forgotten Realms, or
every,
you know,
song they sing,
else,
every legend they tell is completely true.
Exactly. So that's what makes it so much better. You know, you go to the unknown, and it's great because, you know, you have no idea. And it's, you know, for those creative types that like to make stuff up and are good at it, it's a great outlet to do. So I think that's, you know, the way to go there. But maybe that's not your thing, and it's, you know, it's more the high fantasy thing or whatever else like that. And then you get to the detail. I think in a homebrewed campaign, that puts a lot of work onto, say, the GM, especially if this isn't something he's been doing for years. Now, in my case, I played with two different GMs that basically spent years of time making up a world to play in. So they had some detailed stuff, like, you know, we're talking one of those, the big, like, 5-inch 3-ring binders that, you know, encompass the world, and they have the pages and pages and pages on the religions and whatever, you know, whatever else like that. Not only that, you know, I spent even time with both of them, you know, going over this, that, and the other to sort of bounce ideas back and forth. So it's a lot of work. So it's not something that I think the listeners are going to say, oh, okay, yeah, I want to do that. I want to do that for my characters. Don't think that this is something that you're going to just go out and spend a weekend doing, and you're going to come up with this kind of detail and this kind of mystery and mythos that we're talking about here. It's a large investment. It's a very worthwhile investment. I have wonderful experiences to look back on because of it, but it is a lot of work.
I think homebrews could be the best place to do that too, because like you're saying, these people have spent years and years and years in making all this material, even if it's all printed, even if it's all written. Nobody knows it better than the person who's telling the story, because it came out of their head. Exactly. And that's my concern with some of these books, is that you're going to have people expecting things out of the book that you didn't know existed, or basically out of character knowledge.
I don't agree with that at all.
You don't agree with Pat, or you don't agree with Wayne or the whole kind of,
okay. Explain.
Because I think that you can accomplish that same goal with a pre-existing campaign or a pre-existing rule system or whatever you want to call it. To jump back on one thing, all of this, I blame Plane Shift the spell. If there had not been Plane Shift the spell, you wouldn't have the knowledge of what lies beyond and outside your front door. And yes, granted, you can channel some powers, but you still don't necessarily know where they come from. You know, Plane Shift, of course, then allows you to know and do these things. But that's I'll leave that alone. But here's one way I think that you can effectively get around the whole mythology thing, with the caveat being you have to have players that you can trust. And this goes whether you have a screen or not. As a GM, and this kind of goes a little bit to what Pat was saying, with you know what your players are playing, what their characters are, and so you know what their class is, what their background is, or what their general skill set is, it is very easy to come up with a 1-to-3-page little rundown sheet of here is what your character knows, here is his worldview, and you run that down. Here's what he knows in regards to, knows maybe and or believes in regards to magic. Here's what he knows or believes in regards to the undead. Here's what he knows and believes in regards to Monster X that might be a bit more fantastical in nature.
Let me pause you to challenge you on two things.
Okay.
One, first of all, that's an awful lot of work for the GM.
It sounds like it is, but it's really not. When you boil it down and do it, this is something as a GM I could do and would be pretty easy to do. Okay. But go ahead.
Second, my other point I was going to challenge you on is it is impossible, no matter how hard we try, no matter how much we want to believe otherwise, to separate the player from the character. If you tell someone this is what your character believes, but deep down the player knows something else is coming, you will never elicit the experience that you can get from genuinely confusing the player.
Well, I agree that that's true. I would concede that point. If you have players that you can trust, you can at least create the group illusion of a lot of these things. So you can have those players act in an appropriate manner. Yes, it may not be necessarily genuine, but with veteran players, it's difficult to get that on a consistent basis anyway. I mean, even, you know, I don't think that the example you gave with Skies of Glass was something that happened all the time. I mean, you're pointing out one specific example where it worked and worked well. But in general, I'm sure they weren't walking around, you know, all dreamy-eyed the entire time.
No.
But I would say in that one story, in that one instance, it was less the player's actions that made that fun for them, but the fact that the people, not the characters, had to stop and think, what's he going to do?
But see, even with the knowledge base that you provide each player, that here's what your character knows, that's just what they know and or believe. That doesn't mean that it's a truth. You know, as a GM, I would even expect you as a game master to come back later on and make one of those things that are on those little player knowledge sheets to be wrong, and then have them surprised by that.
Would you at least concede that's easier to do in a setting the players don't know than one they do know?
Yes, Yes, it probably would be, because you would be kind of walking into an unknown. But even in my homebrew campaign, you know, when they encounter a ghoul as a character, they kind of know, okay, we know what a ghoul can do, or we have, you know, we're pretty sure what a ghoul can do. So there are still some things that they're going to, you know, they're going to know and or expect.
In the most recent Forgotten Realms campaign I ran, which admittedly was several years ago, and I hope to run again at some point here for my current gaming group, because it was, I mentioned it many times, it's a fantastic campaign. But just having a background with Curse of the Azure Bonds and Pool of Radiance and things like that, I'm a big fan of the pre-Time of Trouble stuff. You know, I like it back when Bane and Moander were still around.
Oh, yeah, good times there.
But one of the things...
Bane and Moander were really evil, terrible gods.
They were very... horrible things. Moander was basically a trash god. I mean, literal, all but literally. But anyway, there were two things that I did when I ran that campaign that I thought helped me to really still capture that sense of wonderment, despite being what's obviously a mid or maybe even high fantasy setting. One was I used very few Monster Manual monsters. Almost all the monsters that they encountered were ones that I had made up. And so I would describe them, and of course the players, being informed voters, were sitting there with their own monster manuals trying to figure out what I was describing, and it was nowhere in the book. And so suddenly they did not know precisely what these things were capable of or why certain things were happening. And secondly, I also backwrote a mythology that sat on top of the mythology they had. So they had a certain understanding of the gods and goddesses and how they came to be and where they came from and what their portfolios were. But there was another greater truth that underwrote all of that, that I had simply invented on the spot, and Ed Greenwood et alia never had in mind, that left them guessing. I think one of the greatest examples, and I'm going to stick with Forgotten Realms, that has been written for this, and I'm going to pronounce something, forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, because I've never heard it said, I've only seen it in writing, is the religion they did post-Time of Troubles for those that worship Ao, the over-god. Where basically you have a guy, and his name is just spelled A-O. Okay, just the letter A and the letter O. And if I'm pronouncing it wrong, you'll forgive me. It's like I said, I've never heard it said. But you had this whole sect that followed Ao because he had exposed himself. And previously to this point, no one had known there was a god for the gods. They thought that power stopped.
Or that he was such a perv.
Oh, my.
But everyone,
okay, good, I wasn't the only one.
Everyone had presumed that the power just stopped at Umberlee or Helm or whatever. Nobody knew there was something over them.
He is power level 5,000.
But the fact is, he had no interest in mortals. Nobody really knew what he stood for. Nobody really knew what he wanted. But damn it, that did not stop cults from popping up that worshipped him. Because they said, hey, I can either worship somebody's underling, or I can go straight back to the source. But they really have no idea what the source is like, what he wants, or if he even really cares.
But in human society...
And they even gave... Well,
there's no end of people who would be totally willing to explain every single one of those questions to you. Right or wrong.
And the book even said, mm-hmm. that when it was describing this, that they very likely were wrong. In fact, it even talked about how gods or goddesses, real ones that were involved more directly in human life, might pose as Ao, trying to garner these people as their own personal worshipers, lying about who they were. And so suddenly you get this sense of, you're in the cult of Ao, who is really answering your prayers? Mm-hmm. And it's this great thing they did. Like I said, and on top of that, I had written my own back mythology behind that, that even within an established setting, left the players and the characters alike guessing about what things really meant.
If you're doing that much writing, though, when does it cross over between being an established setting and now a homebrew based on the established setting?
I would say the devil's in
fan
the
deep. Fanfic sort of GMing?
Well, yeah. Without the homoeroticism. But
damn.
I would say
what
that
a crappy game that is. Yeah.
The devil. It'll have it if Pat's running it.
That's right. The devil's in the details. That what it saved me was I could write the high level stuff that's going on. I could write about the world changing events, the origin of creation, things like that. But if they walked into a particular town, I could open a source book and be like, this is what you've encountered, and here's a map of the town, and here's who's there. I did not have to drill down to creating everything. I just had to write a certain high-level story.
Holy crap, guys, we're at in 90 minutes.
Yeah, edited, this might fall back a little bit, but this is going to be a long show. Like I said, Fear the Boot may disappear for a week. We're not pod-fading, it's just
we are.
Yeah, okay, fine. We're pod fading. But we also have some server issues I need to work out.
We've jumped the shark. We're pod fading. We talk too much.
I think
so
he's
we're
just,
done.
I think he's just gotten a taste of 3-hour podcasts. And so now,
yeah, I did.
That's the way it's going
to
be.
Which you could find his link to it, but if the forums are down.
Yeah, you're not going to. Well, it's not the forums, it's the blog, but yeah.
Besides, everybody knows it's the girth, not the length.
So, I guess we'll go ahead and leave that on Pat's brilliant thought. So.
We love you, Pat.
Yeah.
Daylight come and we want to go. Sorry, I'm singing the hymn of your god, Ale.
Yes, no, thank you. Harry would be proud. So, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. You can look up exactly what a black tarantula is, which is actually a wandering spider, if you're familiar with that song. And we will catch you next time.
What the hell are you talking about?
Ale. Yeah.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.